From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump gave his first joint press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington today. They talked about the prospects for Mideast peace.
Bibi and I have known each other a long time. A smart man, great negotiator. And I think we're going to make a deal. It might be a bigger and better deal than people in this room even understand. That's a possibility. So let's see what we do.
Let's start.
Doesn't sound too optimistic, but that's...
Well, that moment came after Trump said he'd like to see Israel, quote, hold back on building new settlements. Trump also said he's not wedded to longstanding U.S. policy of pursuing a two-state solution to the conflict. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us. Hi there, Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so first of all, let's talk about what the president said, that he could see a two-state solution, he could see a one-state solution. It depends on, in his words, what both the sides wanted. How much of a change is this from what we've heard from previous administrations?
It was a very Trumpian answer. Everything's transactional. Everything can be made as part of a deal. There's nothing yes, nothing no, maybe this, maybe that. And what he seemed to be saying was he wants something to get rolling for there to be negotiations or discussions, and he doesn't want to prejudge the outcome. There are a lot of people who view his comments as breaking with U.S. policy of the past, which said that there has to be an Israeli and a Palestinian state that come about at the end of any Middle East negotiations. Or you could see him saying what American presidents always have, that they want to facilitate whatever deal the parties think is the best one for them, however it comes out. And we'll just have to see what Trump does. But as you heard in that clip with him and Prime Minister Netanyahu, he wants to view this as a fluid situation, a deal very much like the way he treated the one China policy before he later communicated to the Chinese leader Xi Jinping that the U.S. would continue to observe it after all. So we'll just have to watch and see what Trump and the United States do going forward.
Mm. Well, there were so many interesting moments in this joint appearance today. One of them came from an Israeli journalist who, in the opportunity to ask questions, actually turned to the president and asked Trump about rising anti-Semitism and hate and xenophobia in the United States, and basically asked whether or not the president sees his administration as facilitating that. Here's how the president responded.
We are going to have peace in this country. We are going to stop crime in this country. We are going to do everything within our power to stop long simmering racism and every other thing that's going on, because a lot of bad things have been taking place over a long period of time. I think one of the reasons I won the election is we have a very, very divided nation.
I should note that the president began that response by talking about how much he won the Electoral College by. But Phil Ewing, give us your reaction to this, that the president was even asked about this question.
This is something the Trump campaign team, as it's become the Trump transition and then the Trump administration, has had to deal with now and again when they've been asked retrospectively about the 2016 campaign, which for a lot of observers in the United States and around the world included winks and nods and dog whistles and secret codes to the so-called alt-right, this movement of nationalist groups, white nationalist groups, many of which included what people perceived to be anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic sentiment. Now here's Trump in the kind of unusual place that Israel occupies for the United States and for Republicans, trying very hard to make friends with the Prime Minister of Israel, trying to make a sharp break with the policy of his predecessor, who did not get along with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And it's a very odd moment, because for however much of that was deliberate on the part of the Trump campaign and however much was people hearing things that might not have actually been there, now, at least in the view of these Israeli reporters and the Israeli audience at home, Trump is still kind of accountable in their mind for some unanswered questions and some potentially ugly
right.
things that took place in the campaign context.
So in the last minute that we have, Phil, there was a moment where the biggest domestic story going on right now, the Washington story, and the Middle East and Iran actually all came together when the president was asked about his desire to negotiate or create some kind of new Iran deal, and whether or not that would be hampered by all of this news and reporting about his campaign's connections or alleged connections with Russia and Russian intelligence officials. What was his response?
Well, Trump is very aggressive about what he calls the illegal or un-American campaign of information that's appearing in the Washington Post and the New York Times and on CNN and elsewhere about the investigations taking place into his administration and his former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, who stepped down earlier this week. And what it speaks to is the dilemma for a White House still within the first month of its term that is dealing with its own challenges, its own palace intrigue, and doesn't really have the energy or the bandwidth to deal with these crises that are taking place elsewhere around the world, whether it's Russia, Iran, or any of the others.
Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. Thanks so much, Phil.
Thank you.
Well, for more now on the relationship between Israel and the U.S., as represented now by Netanyahu and Trump, let's bring in Dov Waxman, professor of political science, international affairs, and Israel studies at Northeastern University and co-director of that school's Middle East Center. So, Dov, professor, as we just heard, the sort of the two-state solution, traditional oath pledged, has been sort of, you know, the outline of that has been sort of blurred a bit. But what else did you hear today that jumped out at you?
Well, I mean, much of what happened at the meeting was what you would imagine, the handshakes, the big smiles, the expressions of an unbreakable bond between the two countries and the shared values. But what was interesting was when President Trump in particular went off message, or in his unscripted asides to Prime Minister Netanyahu, in particular when he talked about the compromises that he expects of both sides, and mm-hmm. kind of pointedly looked at Netanyahu in that and said, you know, you have to make compromises. And also when he referred to the settlement issue as well, which was obviously going to be something of their negotiations. And in that, he also said, you know, he expects Israel to hold back on settlements. That suggests possible conflicts to come in that relationship.
Yeah. And what do you think about, as we just heard President Trump saying, one state, two state, whatever they want, I like, and an Israeli journalist trying to pin down Prime Minister Netanyahu on, you know, are you dispensing with a two-state solution? We didn't really get an answer there. How significant were those exchanges?
Well, I think from the from President Trump's point of view, he was in some ways doing Prime Minister Netanyahu a favor by not explicitly insisting upon a two-state solution as the necessary solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, even though by all accounts, that really is the only way to reach a solution to the conflict. Mm-hmm. So he didn't kind of drop it in Netanyahu's lap, if you like. Netanyahu, of course, has been under a great deal of political pressure back home to renounce a two-state solution. He danced around that. He didn't renounce it. He didn't actually mention the magic words two states either. But again, I think we shouldn't read too much into this, because at the end of the day, if President Trump is sincere about trying to reach a peace agreement with the Palestinians, then a two-state solution is still the only game in town.
Well, and he did say, Netanyahu did repeat, and as you're saying, he's getting a lot of pressure at home from people further to the right than he is. But he said there's just two requirements we have. One is that the Palestinians have to recognize the right of Israel. And secondly, we'd have to have control of security on the region. I want to ask you about another moment. I want to ask about the tone of it. Because at one point, Prime Minister Netanyahu seemed to really want to make the case of how threatened Israelis feel from Palestinians and from Iran. In talking of Iran, he said, you know, they have missiles that say on them in Hebrew, death to Israel. And President Trump chimed in with his thoughts of how threatened Israel was and how, you know, Palestinians were or radical Islamists were teaching their children about hating Israel. Your thoughts on that tone?
Well, in a sense, it's not really. This is classic Netanyahu. Netanyahu tends to emphasize the dangers and the threats that Israel faces.
But an American president bringing up his own sense of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's really echoing the views of many of his own right-wing advisors on Israel, who also have emphasized that it's the Palestinians who are at fault for a failure to achieve a peace agreement with Israel. It's the Iranians who threatened the region, Iranian aggression, who see Israel in many ways as still this kind of small, embattled, vulnerable country surrounded by enemies, whereas in actual fact, the reality is that Israel is a strong state. In many ways, it's in the strongest position it's ever been in the region. Yes, it does face threats, but this depiction of Israel as deeply vulnerable, embattled, and surrounded by hate doesn't entirely accord with the reality of Israel's strategic position in the Middle East today.
But, you know, it doesn't take... most people aren't looking at the broad view. They're looking at the incidents of violence that they are still feeling in that region, just to have said that. But how do you think the Palestinians read what they heard today?
Well, I think on the one hand, they might be, given the fact that they were fearing the worst, that they, that President Trump would give Netanyahu a complete green light to expand settlements or even absolutely renounce the two-state solution, in some sense, they might have come away slightly relieved that President Trump continued to reiterate his desire to reach a peace agreement, and he insisted that that would involve compromises with the Israelis as well. On the other hand, the depiction of the Palestinians as simply filled with hate, as teaching their children to hate Israelis, as completely avoiding mention of the occupation, of Palestinians' legitimate grievances, of Palestinian suffering, the kinds of things that President Obama, by contrast, would make reference to. That's obviously something that Palestinians will feel deeply upset about, because it completely fails to recognize their reality or some of the reasons why Palestinians do hate Israel.
That's Dov Waxman, professor of political science, international affairs, and Israel studies at Northeastern University, co-director of that school's Middle East Center, talking about today's meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. And they are meeting still as we speak. Dov, professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
President Trump tweeted today, quote, "The fake news media is going crazy with their conspiracy theories and blind hatred. MSNBC and CNN are unwatchable." That was in response to reports that U.S. intelligence services traced repeated contacts between Trump's campaign staff and Russian intelligence officials. Now, the president has long battled parts of the media, but Jason Stanley argues that political speech in Washington may now be veering into a kind of authoritarian propaganda. Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale University. He's author of How Propaganda Works. And when I spoke to him, we started by exploring the long tradition of American politicians and their use of propaganda.
The goal of all party propaganda is to make your allegiance to a political party like your allegiance to the Patriots, where, you know, you don't really think, you just follow. But the Democrats and the Republicans have long done that. There are people who will vote for the Republicans or the Democrats no matter what. But typically, allegiance is to the ideals these parties represent. And at our best, our politics is an open dialogue between about the conflict, if such there be, between liberty and equality, our two great democratic values. But it really looks like when Trump talks about the movement, mm-hmm. what he's talking about is allegiance to him, allegiance to Trump.
Well, so let me ask you just in more detail then. You've written about how you believe your analysis is that the manner of propaganda that Donald Trump uses is along the lines of authoritarian propaganda. So how would you define that?
So it's classically authoritarian propaganda dating back to Plato's Republic. As Plato says in Book 8, it's necessary for a tyrant to always be stirring up war. And Plato also says the first thing an authoritarian does is to stir up a war. So I think the order, the travel ban is meant to sort of be provocative and to like constantly keep people in fear so that he can represent himself as he said in his RNC speech, as the only solution.
So tell me more, though. I mean, if we were to have a sort of a mini bullet list of the things that are the hallmarks of authoritarian propaganda, you named one of them that is sort of the inviting or stirring up of chaos. What are the other hallmarks?
Dividing us. So the president seems to speak mainly to his supporters and triple down, if anything, upon drawing their support rather than unifying. So the second thing would be simply inventing things whole cloth. That's one thing the media really missed out on. I mean, it's popular to show that you have dominance over the truth. That's what an authoritarian does. So the media kept on waiting for him to be punished for that. But his supporters are attracted by that. The supporters are attracted by his open defiance of reality. I mean, Hannah Arendt says in Origins of Totalitarianism, in describing totalitarian propaganda, the mob really believed that truth was whatever respectable society had passed over with corruption. The modern masses do not believe in anything visible or the reality of our own experiences. what their own experience. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part.
Right. So let me just play a clip here. It's one that's probably familiar to people by now. This is just from a couple of weeks ago when senior administration advisor Kellyanne Conway was pressed by NBC's Chuck Todd about claims that the administration was making about the size of the crowd at President Trump's inauguration, and comments there that were also later made by Press Secretary Sean Spicer. So here's Chuck Todd tangling with Kellyanne Conway.
Why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts?
So, Jason Stanley, I mean, is that exchange making exactly the point that you were making, that what Kellyanne Conway said is exactly what the president's most fervent supporters want to hear, a defiance of those who purport to know reality?
Let me repeat Arendt's words again. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but rather open defiance. The movement is the leader speaks, and you're a follower if you repeat what the leader says. Mm. And that's attractive.
Yeah.
That's
so
attractive.
So there's this underlying assumption that this hasn't happened or doesn't happen often in American political discourse. But I wonder about that because, you know, it was the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, who famously gave the world that phrase, "We're not a reality-based administration."
Absolutely. It started then, and we saw when they sent Colin Powell out to repeat what were lies, that sort of made Colin Powell complicit. You saw General Powell is a very noble man, and it was a very sad moment in our history to see that happen, to see him being sort of forced to be part of this big lie. But yes, as Karl Rove said, you know, we're an empire now. We create our own reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that definitely, the Iraq war, that's why the president is always returning to the Iraq war, right? He's always saying, look, you know, we're not exactly innocent ourselves. Every time he's accused of bending reality, he returns to the Iraq war and says, well, the elites did it too.
Jason Stanley, I wonder if we could just step back in history a little bit here, because I'm curious. I've read that your grandmother, I believe, lived in pre-World War II Germany and
yes.
Wrote a memoir about her time there. And there's some lessons to be drawn from her experience. Tell us about that.
Well, the lessons to be drawn, there are many lessons. I believe that there was the kind of creation of an artificial enemy. In that case, it was the Jewish people, my people. In this case, I fear it's American citizens of Islamic faith. And there were years of provocation. My father was growing up in Berlin as a small child, and when he was learning to read, he reported to me that he would read these horrible things, and they were about him. And it took him a while to recognize that he was the enemy, and that at a certain point, Jewish children were excluded from parks, and there was a constant provocation. And the constant provocation led to a terrorist incident, a German-Jewish citizen assassinating Ernst von Rath, a German diplomat. And Joseph Goebbels said, the righteous indignation of the German people must be freed. And that was Kristallnacht. And what is happening, I'm concerned. I hope it's not happening. But the Trump administration will have to prove me wrong. I think we have to prepare for the worst. But if, you know, the constant provoking seems to be leading up to a moment of where there would be someone who would behave horrifically and do a terrorist attack, and then a violent crackdown on our fellow citizens of Islamic faith. That's what concerns me.
Is it really as tenuous as that? Or is it should we look back to other American presidencies and take heart in the fact that the Republic survives regardless of who's in the White House?
I believe in the American people, and I believe that, you know, we will not let our fellow American citizens of Muslim faith down if we are asked to react against them, and I hope we aren't. But I just think that we have to learn from history, and I'm not saying that what I'm that this is. I mean, maybe the administration is just out of control and things are just chaotic and not intentionally chaotic. But there's a constant provocation. Put yourself, my family was the enemy. They grew up as children knowing what it is to be the enemy. There are children hearing this. There are children of Muslim faith hearing this. Every American has to put themselves in the mind of a 7-year-old Muslim child.
All of what you said makes me wonder if really where we should be focusing our attention is on ourselves, the American people, because propaganda, authoritarian or not, only works with the complicity of the people listening to it. And what I'm hearing you say is that people want to hear what the president is saying and how he's saying it, so that instead of looking to him to change, we ought to be looking at each other.
We ought to be looking at each other. I couldn't have said it more directly or more perfectly myself.
And so if that's the case, then how?
We reach out to our fellow citizens who supported him, who didn't believe what he said. Many of my friends who supported Trump, or people I know who supported Trump, thought he wasn't speaking seriously. They said, oh, he's just using the stuff about Islam for politics. Well, that's rarely the case. Authoritarians are always pride themselves on action. So we must reach out to our friends who supported Trump and say, just promise me that you won't overreact if and when something tragic like a terrorist attack happens on our soil.
Well, Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale University. He's author of the book, How Propaganda Works. Jason Stanley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
There's a program at the Cleveland Public Theater called Entry Point. It lets theatergoers get a peek behind the curtain to see a series of plays in progress. It's part of a national movement to bring new voices to the stage. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports.
Playwright and director Meredith King is coaching an actor through a scene from her brand new play, Saturated Fat.
Tim Gunn says that fat girls like us should never wear box pleats, pastels. Yes.
King says the play examines cultural stereotypes about being overweight. Yes. And as someone who has lived with descriptions ranging from plus size to Rubenesque, this is a very personal story for her. And she says the original inspiration came from Twitter.
There was a hashtag called Fat Side Stories. Just seeing these things that people had actually experienced and read about that, frankly, were close to my heart as well. And I was like, we need to do something with this.
Saturated Fat isn't quite done yet, but King and her actors tried this scene out on audiences at Cleveland Public Theater's Entry Point Festival. Executive Artistic Director Raymond Bobkin says 12 works in progress were staged, each one performed 3 nights in a row.
Entry Point is about, at that point of inspiration, at that really early place for the playwright, whether that's I've developed one scene really far enough, it's already up on its feet, or I have a rough draft script.
Audiences provide valuable feedback in this development process, not only through laughter, gasps, and applause, but from post-production Q&A sessions aimed at giving the writers some perspectives that you just don't get in a room by yourself behind that keyboard.
For me, the help is in having the audience in the room and hearing how do the tempos play out, where does it seem to be dragging.
Playwright Eric Coble's plays have been staged in New York and across the country. His latest is an absurd comedy called The Family Klaxon, involving a birthday party, cyber terrorism, and an animal flu outbreak that makes pets spontaneously combust. The piece got what's known as a staged reading, where actors sit on stools and read the entire script.
You can never really judge the effectiveness of a play based on one audience. But over three nights, if the audience keeps responding in a certain way or not responding in a certain way, you can begin to guess, okay, it's probably not the audience, it's probably my play. And that's a big gift.
The Entry Point Festival is part of a larger movement across the country to bring a bigger mix of voices into theater. For instance, the Washington, D.C.-based National New Play Network represents more than 100 theaters who are devoted to nurturing new work. The network established a database featuring thousands of plays and playwrights. Writers can post their work for consideration, and theaters get a larger pool of plays to choose from. Cleveland Public Theater's Raymond Bobkin says it's an opportunity to give a voice to plays born outside of the Big Apple.
So much of the theater in the past has been like this pipeline out of New York. So all the plays sort of had a New York perspective. Now the plays are getting shared from all over the country because of this.
Good. Okay, so what are you thinking for Tracy Knows Best?
Meredith King appreciates the encouragement that all the playwrights are getting.
Some of us came into this with scripts. Others came into this with just nuggets of ideas. And they've been able to help us all in whichever ways that we need. And that's really rare.
King says she's happy with how her play is progressing, and she's looking forward to sharing her nugget of an idea with a bigger audience. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
About 1 in 6 adults in the United States takes a psychiatric medication, such as an antidepressant. And in the last 20 years, the rate of antidepressant use has quadrupled. Yet at the same time, the development of new psychiatric drugs has stalled, even as new drug development for physical ailments has continued. For more on that, we're joined by Meghan Akeshavan, biotech correspondent at STAT, our partners in health and medicine coverage. And you've been writing that there hasn't been a lot of innovation in psychiatric medication over the past couple of decades. Why not?
Well, mental illnesses are very, very complicated. They definitely are biological illnesses, just like any other, like cancer or diabetes. But because they're involved with the brain and with the misfirings of the chemicals in the brain, it's very complicated for researchers to really understand the exact processes that go wrong in a disease like schizophrenia or depression. And so because of that, the industry hasn't really been able to create good drugs to treat them well.
So tell me a little bit more about that and why these drugs are so hard to develop and test. I mean, are they harder than creating new drugs for other physical issues?
Yeah, because they're diseases of the brain, and so they involve very subtle changes in the way that the brain chemistry works. We don't know the exact root cause for many of these mental illnesses. Many, many genes, for instance, are attributed to, say, autism potentially or schizophrenia, but unraveling which specific ones are associated with a specific disease is quite difficult. For instance, schizophrenia isn't just one disease. It could be several different diseases, depending on what genes and what environmental factors cause the symptoms that wind up leading to this mental illness. So without a full understanding of what is causing the disease, it's hard to create just a simple drug that'll fix it.
But as brain science and brain research advances and, say, we hopefully do discover new pathways or biomarkers or root causes for these mental illnesses, then, I mean, will the new drugs get developed more quickly and easily, or are there other sort of institutional obstacles that stand in the way?
It's all very difficult. And yeah, you're right. There are institutional obstacles. There are funding issues, for instance. Mental illness just historically does not get the same funding as something like cancer, you know, other healthcare issues. There's stigma around mental illness. And so patients are sometimes, you know, not treated the same way as somebody who might have a more physical ailment, even though, you know, there are biological reasons for both. So even if an understanding is really unraveled, like it's still quite a uphill struggle. But, you know, they're making some really interesting advances all the same.
Well, I'm curious, though. I mean, one would think that there's a great demand for new treatments, right? Because we're seeing more and more Alzheimer's patients, for example, higher rates of autism. Isn't that just the increase in the prevalence and understanding of mental illness? That's not enough to drive the market to try to develop more drugs?
I think that a lot of companies are starting to get interested again. Novartis, for instance, is building up its psychiatry program. So it just depends, I guess, on which mental illness you're looking at. Something like Alzheimer's affects people, you know, later in life, and there is a easier funding mechanism for a disease like Alzheimer's or even autism. But then when you look at other diseases, it just sort of depends on who the patient population is, and that kind of sometimes affects the amount of efforts that are made to develop drugs for them. But hopefully that'll change.
I think that's a kind way of saying that political power and profit potential matter when it comes to where companies decide where to put their research efforts.
That is generally the case, yeah, yeah.
And there are many, many factors, I acknowledge, that go into how that prioritizing happens. But before I let you go, let me just ask you, are there treatments that researchers are looking at that go beyond pharmaceuticals, non-drug solutions?
Yeah, there are some really interesting advances in terms of digital therapeutics. They're finding that very specially designed video games can help people rewire their circuitry in their brain. And then there's also just like a magnetic stimulation that can right somebody who has depression. Like they can it can sort of jog their brain back into a happier place, I guess. There are new advances in psychotherapy and things like that, coupled with street drugs like ecstasy, that could have potential in helping a mental illness.
Well, Meghna Keshavan is a biotech correspondent at STAT. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
India is fast becoming a major player in the space business. The country made history this week, successfully launching more than 100 satellites in a single mission. That surpasses the previous record, which was set by Russia. The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar joins us from Delhi. So, Sanjoy, tell us more about this. 104 satellites launched at the same time. What's the goal?
Well, apart from the fact that they wanted to score some points over the Russians, who held the previous record, 39 satellites launched in a single mission in 2014. This is very much an attempt to showcase India's technological prowess in space missions, and also the fact that they can do it at half the cost, if not more, when you compare it with other similar missions. Interestingly, only 3 of the 104 satellites were Indian. 96 were actually American, and most of those were from one company, Planet, which was sending up basically satellites which were going to be used to map and carry out navigation work from up there. So, yes, almost all the clients, bar a few, were international. And that gives you a sense of really where India's going with this. It very much wants a slice of what's a very lucrative global commercial space launching market. And the fact that they do it at a very competitive price just gives them that edge.
Interesting. So as you said, private commercial satellites here, the vast majority of them from the United States. I mean, does the world see India as a potential player in the space industry because of this showing? Were they successful in proving that they could do this?
Well, today's launch was absolutely flawless. I mean, I watched it go up, and the critical moment is when about 20 minutes into the flight, when the satellites have to actually separate from the rocket that's carrying them. And you can imagine how tricky that is, because there are 104 of them, even though some of them are quite small. You want to make sure that they don't bump into each other and as they go into their separate trajectories into their orbits. And it all went absolutely according to plan. And if you look back, India's actually had a fairly good track record when it comes to fairly advanced space missions. In 2014, for instance, they sent a maiden mission to Mars. They were the only country to actually succeed in their very first attempt. It's taken others, such as NASA, several tries before they got it right. And they did it at a ridiculous cost. The NASA mission, MAVEN, cost, I think, somewhere beyond $600 million. India's mission was about $71 million. It was even cheaper than the movie Gravity. So it gives you really a sense of, you know, what they're able to achieve and how they're able to keep the prices so low as to make it attractive.
Now, how does India's space program compare with, you know, other Asian nations who've been making strides here? I'm thinking China in particular.
Well, China's India's main rival, really, when it comes to this market. I mean, the Japanese and the Koreans have stated intent, but they have a long way to go before they catch up. At the moment, the Chinese are working on sending up its own space station. by 2022. It's also said it's going to send a lunar mission to, you know, the other side of the moon, the one that's no one's actually been to as yet. They've got ambitions of their own. But India's real calling card, if you like, is the fact that they keep it small and they keep it cheap, rather like their, you know, their other industries like the call centers, for instance.
And so, Sanjay, how was this news of the successful launch received in India amongst the people there?
Well, as you can imagine, it was seen as a moment of pride. I mean, I was watching not just the scientists who started clapping and cheering when that rocket took off, but even people who were watching from a distance. This is a spaceport in the Southeast Indian coast, just off the Bay of Bengal. So you can almost, like in Florida, you can sort of see it take off from a distance. And there were people who'd gathered there just to watch the rocket take off. There were obviously a lot of cheering going on when that happened. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, was very quick to take to Twitter to shower his congratulations. He described it as a very, very proud moment for India. It's India's space program is seen as really something they do well. People are very proud of their achievements. It's done, you know, it's run by people who are very, very earnest in what they do. They do it at a fraction of the salaries that their counterparts get in the United States and other parts of the Western world. And that is why people here are really, really pleased with the success of their missions.
That's the BBC's Sanjay Majumdar speaking to us from Delhi. Sanjay, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Now to that spike in heroin overdose calls in Louisville, Kentucky, a record number. In 32 hours from midnight last Wednesday to 8 a.m. on Friday, almost 2 calls an hour. That's the highest rate this year in Kentucky, which is one of the state's hardest hit by the epidemic. Dr. Robert Couch is the Emergency Department Medical Director at Norton Audubon Hospital in Louisville. He's with us on Skype. And Dr. Couch, there was a huge overdose surge in Cincinnati last August. They had 174 overdoses in 6 days. Now, they blamed carfentanil. That's the drug used to sedate elephants that gets mixed in with the heroin. And it's 100 times more powerful than fentanyl. So do you know why you had your spike in Louisville?
We suspect it's related to fentanyl analogs like carfentanil. And unfortunately, these drugs are being produced in illicit labs, and many times we're not exactly sure what opioid we're treating. Heroin has been with us for a long time, and there are people who have abuse patterns that have been fairly stable. But what's driving people into hospitals is that the heroin is being laced with these fentanyl analogs that make it much more toxic from a medical standpoint, which can lead to respiratory depression, respiratory arrest, where people stop breathing. And unless they're treated within 4 to 6 minutes of the time they stop breathing, these drugs can lead to irreversible brain damage and death.
Which is why people are lining up there in Louisville, and they're in other cities as well, being trained on how to use naloxone, which can reverse an overdose. And so people, you know, as you say, 4 minutes, sometimes an ambulance can't even get there. So people are supplying themselves with it so they can save loved ones or people they meet on the street. But I'm understanding that these heroin abusers are building up almost an immunity to naloxone. They need more of a dose.
Well, I don't think they're building up immunity. I think the drug that they're ingesting has a much longer half-life and a much stronger affinity for the receptor site in the brain. Huh. So we're having to use higher and higher doses of naloxone, and we're having to give them repeatedly, sometimes to the point of having to put patients on naloxone continuous infusions.
Well, but I'm wondering, and these were some of the questions that came around naloxone when it first was introduced. You know, we're hearing that you're getting these repeat overdose victims, but then they go right back out and use again. Do you as a doctor wish there was a way that you could interrupt that cycle legally, you know, force them to stay in the hospital? I mean, if they know that there's going to be naloxone that will save them from an overdose, won't they just keep cycling through?
Unfortunately, many times that happens. We encourage people to seek treatment, but unfortunately, the reality is that oftentimes within minutes of being resuscitated, literally from being dead to alive, they will try to leave the hospital. And we try to encourage them as best we can to get into treatment, but many times they don't avail themselves of what's available.
Well, meantime, you talk about the costs. We understand Louisville announced that the police department is going to hire 150 more officers and add two new squads of detectives to address narcotic crime, try to get the dealers off the street, try to get the source off the street. But what kind of pressure does this put on an emergency room?
At Norton Audubon Hospital, we're ready for whatever comes through the door, but it does put increased pressures on the whole medical care delivery system. Not only from resuscitating people who have overdosed on heroin, but it's treating all of the other complications that are associated with IV drug use, such as hepatitis C, HIV, drug-resistant bacterial infections, heart valve infections, abscesses. That puts a tremendous strain on our medical care system.
And do you think that each spike becomes a new normal? I mean, we understand that while there was that spike over a couple of days, on average, the overdose calls have almost doubled. Those are the, you know, the trucks going out, the ambulances going out. Do you worry that it's just going to, these aren't going to be spikes anymore? It's just the way it will be.
It does seem to be the new normal. It's a very unusual day that we don't have multiple heroin overdoses. I mean, I wish there were days when we didn't have very many, but I haven't had a day like that in a long time. So it is something that that we're experiencing. It takes a tremendous toll on not only physicians and nurses, but also on our pre-hospital first responders, paramedics, EMTs, fire department staff, police department staff, who are responding to these emergencies, because many times the people that they're encountering are already deceased. And to do that day in and day out just puts a tremendous emotional toll on people.
Yeah, can only imagine. And for the families who know that there's this, you know, this killer on their streets that you want to try to keep loved ones from. That's Dr. Robert Couch, the Emergency Department Medical Director at Norton Audubon Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, after a spike in heroin-related overdoses that may, as he said, be the new norm. Doctor, thank you. Best of luck.
You too. Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.